Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we talk about on this podcast. I share strategies and ideas. I tell stories. I share some of the big epic mistakes I've made on this journey. And I also like to occasionally bring on guests. I've been adding more guests to the show lately, and I am super excited about the guest that we have right here. It is someone named Tom Gibson, and I'll tell you a little bit about him. All right, I have Tom Gibson here, and he's going to be talking about this idea of classroom jobs. And I just have to say ahead of time, I was a little bit skeptical about this topic. And that's because I attempted as a teacher when I taught middle school to do classroom jobs, and it just became overwhelming for me. So they weren't self-sufficient. They weren't self-directed. I think I made a lot of different mistakes along the way. So I want to actually start with this question. Why should we even have classroom jobs? Let's start there and then kind of move from there.
I think there's quite a few reasons to have them. I think one of the things is it kind of builds a positive classroom community. Because in my classroom, all of my students have a classroom job. It's not like you can't have one. Everyone is contributing in some way, in some capacity to the classroom. And so I think that creates a positive environment where it's where we all have our part here. And so I think that's one of the big things. The other thing is really to help the teacher. When I was creating my class jobs originally, I started when I was teaching fifth grade. And originally all the jobs were pretty much the same jobs that you would see in any elementary school, of like the line leader, or like the person who's at the caboose, who's at the end of the line, or like, you know, little things here and there just to give kids jobs. But I started to try to rethink jobs in ways of like, what are things that I do in the classroom every day that I could delegate to a student and offload those tasks off of me? Because that did two things. It gave me less tasks that I had to do, and it made the student realize like, this is a job that actually has to get done. Someone has to be the person that plugs in the computer into the projector and pulls up the class website to project the opening bell ringer activity for the class. Like, it wasn't just an arbitrary job. And so I thought as much as possible, me and you have talked previously about Tim Ferriss. I read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week, and his whole thing was like, what can you automate and what can you delegate, you know, and what can you stop doing altogether? That delegate piece, I was like, what are things that I'm doing that I could delegate to my students? And so that really kind of helped transform a lot of the different types of jobs that I ended up having. And so it creates that positive classroom culture. It takes some of the tasks and some of the burdens of getting everything done in the classroom off of my shoulders and put some of it onto the kids, giving them more responsibility, going back to that classroom culture piece. And in my class, I feel it gives them an opportunity to learn 21st century skills. For them, they apply for their classroom job. And so they have to go through the whole job application process. And we have a big conversation on like, don't tell me you want this job because you think it's a cool job. That's not like convincing me as your employer to want to hire you. Instead, I want you to tell me, what is it that you would bring to this job that would be helpful to me? What is it that you would bring to this job that would be helpful to our classroom community, our company, if you will? You know, and so we have that conversation about adding value to the company as opposed to like how things are going to benefit you. And so that's a really good skill to learn as early as middle school. And then the different kinds of jobs, they can be learning different skills that maybe they really wouldn't learn otherwise. Like, I have a podcaster in my class, and so they're learning what goes into a good podcast. I have a newsletter writer, so they're learning what are some tools online that I can design a really professional newsletter, even though I'm not a professional graphic design artist. I have all different types of jobs that are teaching them these skills. And I remember when I was in person, I had a photographer and a videographer in class. They had to take photos that I told them, like, these are going to go on my teacher Instagram account, you know? And so they would come up with suggested captions and suggested hashtags. And so they're learning about social media marketing and branding through that. And really seeing like, this isn't just photos that Tom is, that I'm giving to Tom in an email that no one ever sees again. Like, they actually have an authentic audience for the work that they are doing. And so I think it kind of bundles all of these things together, from classroom culture and community, taking care of things that I would normally have to take care of, and teaching them 21st century skills, all wrapped up in them having these classroom jobs.
Yeah, one of the things I'm struck by as I hear that is, you know, it fits in to what we talk about a lot on the on this podcast, which is the idea of empowering students, right? Of developing soft skills. I've talked before about this idea of asking the question, what are we doing for students that they could be doing for themselves? And so I can see how this leads to students being self-directed, right? Being self-managers, being self-starters. I can see where this leads to that, you know, those soft skills that they develop, but also, you know, the creative skills, the podcasting, that. But then I also hear this and I think, oh my gosh, that sounds like a lot to front load. That sounds like a lot to teach students ahead of time. And managing that seems like it would be a nightmare. So what would you say to teachers who say, look, I want students to do classroom jobs, but I'm barely swimming right now. I'm struggling. You know, we've gone into hybrid mode and I don't know what this looks like. And now they're just, the upfront side feels overwhelming to them. What advice would you give to that teacher?
Yeah. What I would say is, first, I would make a list of some of the biggest pain points, some of the things that you have to do every day in the classroom that just eat away at your time, whether it's like, I've got to organize the PPE in our classroom, or I've got to write the agenda on the board, or I have to plug in my computer and pull up the website, or I've got to even open the blinds. I've had a class job of a student who just comes in and makes sure the blinds are open so we have natural light in the classroom. I would say make that list first, because that is going to help inform you in some of the jobs that you're going to have, and kind of think like, oh, these are all the things that I can actually take off of my plate. I'm feeling overwhelmed right now, and I can actually take it off my plate. And this is not just for elementary school. Like, when you think about it, middle schoolers and high schoolers are capable of higher order classroom jobs that take a little bit more responsibility than maybe a 7 or 8 year old would be able to handle. And so I would say, mm-hmm. get that list in order. And I would have to create as much, I think what's really important with these classroom jobs is getting as much buy-in from the students, because I think teachers are like, I have to make sure everyone does their job. And that seems to be a headache. But if you create as much buy-in and you get the kids that they actually want to do their job, that's going to help in the process. And so with the job application process, they have to apply for their top three jobs in order of preference. And so I would love this job. And then second, I would love this job. And third, I would love this job. And then again, on that job application, they're working to convince me why I should hire them for that job. Which, as if you think of a situation where I was going through and I was assigning the students to jobs and I was the one saying, this is why you should be excited about this job, I'm turning that around on them. They're convincing me why they should be the one. And so like, it even like, it makes them think about the job a little bit differently, as opposed to a responsibility that I have to do, but something I hope that I get to do this. I hope I get to have this job. And so I, just even the process of that, I explain all my jobs to my students, and then they fill out a Google form, and then I can look at that Google form, and as much as I can, I try to give students one of their top three jobs to create as much buy-in as possible. And then I let them know which job they ended up getting. As far as like, okay, well, how am I going to make sure they actually do their job correctly? Maybe they're all bought in. I love checklists. I read The Checklist Manifesto.
I love that book.
By Atul Gawande, right? A surgeon. Yeah. If a surgeon needs a checklist to remember what he needs to do in surgery, then we are not above checklists. We as teachers are not above checklists, and our students are not above checklists. Even if they think, oh, I remember, give them checklists, a step-by-step, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, then do this. A lot of the times, if it's a digital job, I may have a checklist that that I give them, but it is supplemented by a screencast where I give them a tutorial and maybe on how to do their newsletter using Adobe Spark or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think having that checklist easily and readily available, it could even be like if you have someone that's organizing for you. One of my classroom jobs is the KonMari organizing specialist, named after the Marie Kondo method, who's just like, if you're really into organizing and have seen that Netflix documentary, you're going to have students that are super into organizing and having everything in the right place. They could have a checklist of what needs to be organized in the classroom, and you can even have like a photo of what it should look like. And so you want to give your students as much support so they know exactly what's expected of them in their job. And then those first few times that they're doing their job, give them immediate feedback. You tell them, okay, this, yes, exactly like this. This part was not quite right. Let's do it again. I had to do this a lot when we're about to go hybrid next week. But when I was in the classroom, I had a boards manager who would write the agenda on the board every day. And she had a Google spreadsheet that I shared with her. And so as long as I kept that up to date, she knew exactly what was going to go on as far as this is what we need to do today. This is what needs to be on your desk. And then I gave her a template of like, here's how I want you to color code it. Here's how I want you to kind of indent things to make this as easy as possible to read to the students. And inevitably, the first time they do it, they don't always remember to color code, or they write too small. I'm like, okay, this looks great. Let's go ahead and try to do it again, but bigger. And then we actually erase it and do it again because I'm creating that expectation. I don't want to create the expectation of like, next time I'll fix it. It's like, no, like I really want this to be right. You know, it's not a punishment. It's just saying, okay, this is what the expectation is. Let's keep practicing it until we get it, which is really like the fundamentals of classroom management. You know, you don't just tell a student what to do, but you rehearse it and you practice it until it kind of becomes automatic for the student. And so at that point, like you said, there is a lot on the front end to kind of set this up because you are creating these checklists and you are deciding what kind of jobs and you are looking through the job applications and hiring students. But once you kind of get past that hump, your classroom is on autopilot. This year, I had a job that was the teacher assistant job because I had so many different jobs that were happening at different points in our virtual classroom. Some jobs that were happening at the beginning of class, maybe someone was sharing the weather. Some jobs that were happening at the end of class. Maybe one of the classes that I thought would be fun would be have a zoologist where the zoologist is taking care of our class pet who happens to be their pets. And they're like, here's my class. Here's Rexy. You know, Rexy had such a great week. You know, and we would do that at the end of the day on Monday or something like that. And so I was not wanting to try to keep track of all these things. My teacher assistant had a checklist of everybody's job and when they had to do it. And then they would go through it at the beginning and end of class, reminding people. And I remember one of the days that I got kicked off of Zoom and my internet went out and I had to reset my computer. And then when I had joined back in, this was like the first couple minutes of class, my teacher assistant was still going through that list and people were doing their classroom jobs, even in my absence, even virtually. And so there is work. There is work on the front end. But I think not only is it going to save you time and then create kind of like that autopilot classroom, like this is really fun. And like we're in a year where it's been so hard to like make class fun, interesting, engaging, something that the students look forward to, something that we look forward to. And this, I feel that this could be that for a lot of teachers that are struggling and like, I don't know what I'm doing. I just feel like I'm keeping my head above water. The kids don't want to be there. I don't want to be there. This could be something that kind of changes, breaks the script a little bit, something a little bit different, and then has all those added benefits that we talked about a little bit earlier.
I love this idea. You know, I'm just hearing you talk about this. I love the idea of beginning with those pain points. You know, I never did a great job with classroom jobs. And I can think of a few reasons why, but you know, one of them is I did have a board manager and I didn't keep it in a spreadsheet. You know, we were required to print our lesson plan. So this person would look at the lesson plan, find the objective. You know, I trained them to do that. And part of it is this, you know, when I was a kid, I blew off two subjects because I said computers will eventually make it so that handwriting is not necessary. So I said handwriting and spelling will be the two things I don't pay any attention to. And Now I'm in literally the only job left that requires handwriting or spelling, right? So, you know, but I had a student with great penmanship who did that. When I think about the mistakes I made, you know, I can think of two different areas there. One is I didn't have a manager managing the people doing the work, which I think you've kind of alluded to, but a class manager who handles that would have been really helpful. The second is I didn't really have a codified process. I didn't create a system. And so if that person was gone, I was up a creek. Or if, you know, so I didn't have multiple people who could do the same job. I didn't have someone who could be a stand-in if that, you know, we lived in a fairly transient area. So there were a lot of students leaving and things. So what I would love to know is, like, how would you troubleshoot the issue of students not being there? You know, like how do you handle that?
Yeah. Piece? In the past, I've had a substitute was a job, and sometimes that was added to, you know, someone who had a regular job and was also the substitute if they wanted to do that. Again, they're applying for it. But that this year, like, my teacher's assistant also serves as the substitute. So it is kind of hard because the teacher assistant does take a lot more training than anyone else. And so, like, if the teacher assistant's out, that is a day that I kind of have to take over. But I make that exact same checklist that this teacher assistant goes through super accessible. It's like bookmarked on my computer. And then I just pull it up and I would just do whatever the teacher assistant's doing. But so they, as long as they are there, they're kind of managing all of that stuff and making sure the jobs are happening. And they are serving as substitute for any of the students that are not there. I have had students kind of come in mid-year. And a lot of times I don't make them go through the entire application process, but I do kind of look to see what I need in that class or maybe some jobs that are not actually taken yet. And then I say, hey, we have this thing where everybody has a classroom job. And these are the ones that we have. Do any of these sound like, you know, interesting to you or something like you would want to do? Because I am still inquiring about what it is that interests them, what it is that they want to do, because I do want to have that buy-in. Or even if it's only one job, you know, that I really need, I would say, would you be willing to do this? And 9 times out of 10, they're like, yeah, I would be willing to do that. And so even just being asked helps create some of that buy-in. And so that's what I've done for students that are coming in, or if a student leaves and then a new student comes in, we kind of do the same thing. Like, hey, the person that came in before you had this job, I think, you know, I think maybe you'd be a good fit for it. Would you like it? And then a lot of times they'll just say, yeah, I'll go ahead and do that job.
So I'm thinking about this and just to kind of summarize so far, you have the development of these classroom jobs, you're hitting the pain points. You're coming up with the classroom jobs. There's going to be a little bit of some training to be done, but it's not super intensive. You're coming up with the checklist, things like that. So there is a little bit of work on the initial side, and then the managing of it gets to be much more self-sufficient. And then it kind of manages itself, which I love. Is there any kind of reward that students get for doing the classroom jobs? Like, walk me through that piece. If I'm a student, why am I going to do this job? And what is it going to look like for me?
Yeah. So in my classroom, I did classroom jobs for several years in fifth grade, just as is. You know, I actually had them on a rotation. They were doing new jobs every 2 weeks. I don't really do the rotations anymore because I don't want to retrain anybody. But I read a book, I think it was my third year of teaching, by Rafe Esquith, rock star teacher. He wrote Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire. And he talked about having something called a classroom economy. And so he had similar class jobs, but instead of just stopping there, they got paid in classroom money. And so the...
Like shrewd, yeah, bucks, sure. Right? It's like,
you get one shrewd buck. Exactly. And I did start with paper, but that was too much to manage. And so it's all virtual now. But with the jobs, it depends on the range of salary. It's not massive, but it's enough to say, like, some jobs, like the teacher assistant that requires a lot of responsibility, are going to be paid the most. And some jobs, like opening the blinds when you get to class, are going to be paid the least. And so you will have some of the kids that are like, not super interested. Just like everything you do, you're not going to win over everybody.
Right.
But you're going to have your kids that are like, my top choice is the guy or the girl who opens the blinds, you know, like, and it's like, okay, that's fine. You know? And so still having some of those jobs that, like, even if they didn't end up getting done, it's not the end of the world, but having these shroot bucks attached to them, it really incentivizes kids because they're not going to get as much money if they don't do their job. And in addition to well, what do they do with the money? There's a few things they do with their money. They have to pay rent. And so their salaries range from about $1,100 to $1,600 a month, and rent is $1,000. So everyone has it's a living wage here in the world of Tommunism, as my students have coined it.
I love it. Yeah.
They have to pay rent. If there's any misbehavior, they may have to pay a fine. That could be for off-task behavior. That could be for missing supplies. You name it, things that you don't want to continue to see happen, you can fine students for that. Or they can finally use their money to purchase items. When we were in person, we had an auction every month, and one of the class jobs was an auctioneer. And not only did they actually like manage the auction, but throughout the month, they would go to local stores with an official letter from me saying that we had this classroom economy. Would you like to donate items for our classroom economy? That is super empowering for a 12-year-old kid to talk to a manager, show them what they're doing, explain the process, and walk out with a $50 toy that they just got for free, or a $25 gift card, or this book trilogy set that all the kids are reading right now in hardcover, you know, brand new. And so they would bring those items to the auction, and then students would bid on the items. And it wasn't always like items that a student got from a store. Sometimes, you know, like you got to bid on, you know, using my teacher chair all month that you could bring over, you know, the nice comfortable chair, or, you know, teachers do homework passes and you can bid on that. Since we've gone virtual, I don't have like physical items, but they can purchase things like a license to be able to have virtual backgrounds during Zoom class, you know, or a license to purchase a voice modulator that you can use in Zoom class, as long as I could still like understand you. I even have, there is ones that a really expensive item that I know a couple students are saving up for. They can pay, if they save up enough money, for me to deliver using food delivery apps, lunch to their house and two of their friends' houses, and we have lunch together provided by me. It's the most expensive thing, because I can't do that more than a few times. But then there's also like stuff where it's like, watch Tom get a pie in the face, you know, where like I actually get a pie and I do it and record it and share it with the class. And so just trying to find fun things that would incentivize them, like, oh, I want to save up for that. So it's things that you could do in person or online. But the classroom money piece is a big motivator, a big incentive for the students. And generally people are wondering, well, like, that also seems like a lot to manage. How do you know how do they get paid? How do they know how much money they have? I have used several virtual banks. There are virtual banks online that you can create a classroom, and then everyone has their own bank account. I've used several. The one that I like the most is called paygrade.io. And the funny thing is, I've met the developer of it. His wife was doing a classroom economy, and then he saw all the different virtual banks that were out there. And he's like, a lot of these are just not really meeting the needs of what you're trying to do. And so he developed PayGrade, you know, as like the, you know, as a really great classroom economy system. But what's great is the students have an account, and I can set up a direct deposit into their accounts. And so I put all the jobs in there and say how much money that job gets a month. And then I assign the jobs to those students, and then it automatically deposits that money for them once a month. And what's nice is, if I assign the student a teacher assistant job, when they log into PayGrade and see their account, not only do they see their checking and their savings account and all that, they actually see their that checklist that I talked about right there in PayGrade, always accessible. So it's not an old email they have to go find, or a Google Doc they have to go hunt for. It's just always available when they log into their bank account. They can see all their transaction history. It really looks like any online bank account. It's a little bit more colorful, a little bit more kid-friendly, but kids are asking, like, you know, what does this mean? 3% APR and 1% APR. What transaction history? How do I pay my rent? Oh, the good thing about your rent is that you're already on auto pay that I've already set up for you, so you don't have to worry about your rent, you know, actually paying it. And we talk about that. And sometimes there's glitches on PayGrade, which creates a really great opportunity to say, you need to be watching your bank account because sometimes things happen. And if you're not paying attention to your banking transaction history, then you could be losing money without even knowing it. And so there's more of those 21st century skills there. And it kind of keeps everything organized for me. If you've ever used Class Dojo as a classroom management system where kids can earn points and lose points, you can kind of create something similar in PayGrade where it's like everyone got money for being on time to class today, or, you know, you two students lost money because you got a job infraction fine because you didn't do your job after being reminded a couple times. And so it's a really powerful tool. Pretty much everything that I do is on the free account. They've got a paid account, which, you know, I think would be really good if you were a financial literacy teacher because it includes stock options. I think there's even cryptocurrency options in there. Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
So I just want to, you know, one area that I could see some teachers pushing back on, and maybe one area of clarification, you know, you talked about fines, and, you know, one clarification is you mentioned having your supplies being prepared for class. And we do know, you know, you are going to have some students showing up who, for equity reasons, just don't have materials. And, you know, we as teachers deal with this. So maybe some clarification there. And then also the broader question, the pushback that some teachers are going to have is, look, I want students, we're a community, you know, not a business. I want students to contribute to the class and to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because they're getting a reward for it or whatever, right? You're going to have some, I'm sure you've heard some of that pushback before. So maybe if you could share, you know, first of all, the thought about being prepped for class, just and equity, you know, that thought, and then the bigger thought of the intrinsic motivation.
Yeah, the prep for class. The nice thing about that is that I am the one that's really, the way I managed when we were in person, the way I would manage the fines is I would have a clipboard, and then if a student was getting a fine, you know, I would put a date next to their name and say what the fine was. And then later I had a student who was our fine officer. They would look at the fine log, and then they would write out tickets for that week and make sure that they got paid. So if I had a student that perpetually just did not have, you know, supplies because they don't have supplies and their parents can't give them supplies, I wasn't going to give a fine to that student every single day. But instead I may create a situation.
I just wanted to make sure you clarified.
Instead I would create a situation where I'd let that student know, like, hey, you know, if you ever need a pencil, I've got some back here. You can go ahead and use one. And that'll be fine. Just put it back when you're done. Or I've even had students rent supplies. And then as long as they put it back, there's no charge or anything like that. So there's a lot of different ways that you could do that. Speaking to the intrinsic value piece of it, I've thought about that a lot, actually. What's interesting is that book by Rafe Esquith was he actually talks about, I think it's Kohlberg's level of moral development. There's all these different levels of why you do the right thing kind of stuff where it's like the lowest level is like, you don't want to get like punished. And then like the highest level is like, you do it because it's, you know, it's even beyond just like your own personal moral compass. It's like, you know, what's for the greater good and everything. And so I was like, well, he teaches this to his fifth graders, you know, but he can also reconcile the fact that he's paying the students for jobs. And so at the time for me, I'm like, well, that's good enough. You know, it's like, but for, as I thought about it more, you know, like one, if you're really feeling kind of like that friction, like you don't have to do this classroom economy. You could just keep it at the classroom jobs because, I mean, I've heard that research too, where it's like, you have all these kindergartners and then they love to draw and then you start paying them to draw. And then when you don't pay them anymore, they don't want to draw anymore because you've created something that they just love to do for the sake of it. Now they're only doing it for this reward. And so I do recognize like that is a reality. I also recognize that it's important for kids to know how.
Well, and I just want to point out.
Go ahead. I also recognize that it's good for kids to kind of like they need to know how to manage money. They are going to have a job in the future that ideally, if we lived in a world where everyone, you know, just had what they needed and we all did our work for free and we never, you know, got some kind of financial compensation for it, the skills wouldn't be necessary, but we work for money. And so how could I simulate those lessons in the classroom in a meaningful way, in a way that honors the kids, in a way that honors their interests as well and doesn't destroy any of that intrinsic motivation that's there, but also teaching them like money is something that you're going to have to learn how to manage, and what better way than actually giving you a role where you do get paid for completing that job.
Yeah, one of the things I'm struck by is I think that distinction we make sometimes between intrinsic, extrinsic is just it lacks nuance. You know, I'm a big fan of self-determination theory where you basically have extrinsic, intrinsic motivation, but it's on a continuum from, you know, a motivation through extrinsic motivation through intrinsic. And then intrinsic really, there's I'm doing it because I love it, which is true intrinsic motivation. There's what we actually tend to think of intrinsic, which is I'm doing this because I find it inherently meaningful, which would be identified regulation. And then you get into, you know, doing things for guilt avoidance and interjected regulation and then extrinsic. And the truth is, in almost all work that we do that for a multitude of reasons and they all work. So like, I love doing creative work. I'm intrinsically motivated to do creative work. I love it. But the desire to create something that someone else loves is very extrinsic. There's nothing wrong with that. Or sometimes when there are pieces that I don't love of it, I will give myself a reward, right? Like if I do blank, you know, it's the whole like, you know, the worst part of writing the book is the first draft and then the revision is fun. I create a reward for myself. Literally, there's a reward. And so I look at it and say, you know, I kind of view it as like, well, I don't think that classroom jobs are going to ruin intrinsic motivation necessarily. You know, it's saying these are things that are chores. I mean, they're things that are, I mean, they're jobs, right? And there's nothing wrong with saying a job gets a reward. I would have a much harder time with a token economy being attached to, say, free reading, right? Where you're reading whatever you want. That's where I see it backfiring. So I think that some of that distinction makes a difference in recognizing that even in the things we love, I mean, look, we all love teaching, but we also want our paycheck, right? Like we also want that. So even with the things we love, there's still that component. As we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your course. So one of the things that I'm struck by, I did kind of a cursory look, haven't been through the whole course or anything. I'll just own that. But I do love how practical and explicit you have laid things out. One of the things, I subscribe to your newsletter. If you're listening, please subscribe to Tom's newsletter. One of the things I love is how very intentional your advice is and how incredibly specific it is. So I think about, for example, you know, on a recent one where you laid out how to have students self-select their Zoom meetings, right? Like that, little things like that, I think are the bits and pieces that remind me, yeah, you're in the classroom doing this work and you're making it explicit and you're helping fellow teachers know what works. And that was really the from the first time you reached out and we talked a long time ago, I was like, your intentionality is huge. And so I love that about the course, the intentionality, the practicality, the making it visible and explicit. You know, I'll tell you, it's not just like, oh, well, here's an idea. It's really laid out for you. So tell, you know, listeners, what is the course, and just give us a little bit of a preview of it.
Yeah. There's two options. There's two options for people, kind of depending on where they're at. I have a free course that's just on the classroom jobs. With that, I walk through 26 jobs, most of which can be used whether you are fully in person, whether you're in hybrid, whether you're doing distance learning, because a lot of the jobs are really creative in nature. So it's like, if you have a class podcaster, it doesn't matter whether you're remote or in person. If you have a class motivational speaker, it doesn't matter whether you're in person or remote. So I give a lot of different options that are going to work for both contexts. And with that course, I walk through those jobs, and then I tell you about like the job application process, and how to hire students and how to train students. And so it's kind of like that first part of the conversation that we had before we started talking about all the money piece. But this free course has nothing to do with like paying students for their jobs, has nothing to do with online banks, right. Has nothing to do with the financial literacy aspect of things. It's purely classroom jobs. And that course, it's called Essential Student Jobs for the Middle School Classroom of Tomorrow. That's available at tomgibson.com/classjobs. Tom is spelled with an H, tomgibson.com/classjobs. Mm-hmm. Now, if you are kind of like, I would really love to kind of pull in that piece of the classroom money, figuring out how to do pay grade, figuring out how to, you know, do fines, and, you know, how can kids earn extra money in addition to their salary, and what does an auction look like, or mm-hmm. what, you know, all of those pieces. That is my other course called How to Teach Kids About Money. And with this one, I try to make it, as John said, as simple as possible and as clear as possible for you to actually implement this in your classroom. I give you access to all of my Google Docs. And so what I hate the most is like you find a resource online and it's like a PDF or it's like a, you know, Microsoft Word, and then you try pulling it into Google Docs and then you paste it and then it's like all the formatting's messed up. These are like Google mm-hmm. Docs that are ready to be customized. And so you can add, subtract, and change whatever you need to. So a lot of the work is already done for you. You just have to make it the right fit for your classroom. And I walk you through all of that and how to teach kids about money. That is available at tomgibson.com/classroom economy. Again, Tom spelled with an H, tomgibson.com/classroom economy. And so I would check, for most people, I would just check out the free course first. And then if you're like, okay, I really want to kind of keep going with this and kind of make this a classroom economy, then check out the How to Teach Kids About Money course. And this is not just for financial literacy teachers. Like, I do this in my middle school math, my middle school science, and my middle school robotics elective. And so don't think like you have to be like the financial literacy class to do this. And that's going to be where all the resources are and all the how-tos and everything to get you started with this. And I think starting at the end of the year is actually really good. I started my very first full classroom economy like March, mm-hmm. April, that first year that I did it, because it helped me kind of work out a lot of the things that I want, like work out the kinks, like see what I liked, what I didn't like. So that way when you start it and it's like the full year of it, you kind of feel a little bit more prepared. You're not doing it for the very first time. You kind of had your trial run for just a few months there at the end of the year. So I think it's a really great time to start for the first time. And I'm going to go ahead and say, I'll create a coupon code. The coupon code will be Spencer, from Sir John Spencer, mm-hmm. and Spencer will give you 20% off of the paid course, but it is only going to be valid for 2 weeks after, the release of this episode. So all the diehard fans are going to get in on that.
Well, thank you so much for, talking through this together. I was really intrigued by this because, like I said, I one of the main themes of this podcast and of the work I do is, you know, how do we empower students with voice and choice? And I think this fits in perfectly with the idea of an empowered classroom and an empowered community. And, you know, I was initially kind of skeptical because I never did a great job at this because of that time factor. But I think the fact that you've provided the resources and you know, the Google Docs and that kind of work, I think it just becomes very doable. And it's a small thing that really can make a huge difference in terms of helping students develop that soft skills. So thank you so much for being on here and talking through this together. I really do appreciate you giving us your time.
It was a pleasure. I appreciate you having me on, John.
All right. Thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? Again, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.